Well, welcome once again. Last time, this is what we wanted. All right, that's my subject of the day, and this will be my interpretation of what that actually is. And it starts off, we find the parable that involves this, not parable, but the writing of scriptures in three places, Matthew 26, Mark 14, and Luke 22. We're going to read the Mark account out of Mark 14, verses 12 to 16, so we know what we're talking about. This is actually part of what we heard earlier today. Mark 14, starting at verse 12. And on the first day of unleavened bread, when they sacrificed the Passover lamb, his disciples said to him, "Where will you have us go and prepare for you to eat the Passover?" And he sent two of his disciples and said to them, "Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him. And wherever he enters, say to the master of the house, 'The teacher says, where is my guest room, where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' And he will show you a large upper room furnished and ready. There, prepare for us." And the disciples set out and went to the city and found it just as he had told them. And they prepared the Passover. Jesus knew that his Father's righteousness must be upheld, and that his task here on the earth must be completed at a specific time. His Father was in control, and Jesus was making sure that it would be completed as specified. Jesus had limited time to finish preparing his disciples for the future in order to fulfill his Father's wish. We read that from John 6 and 38. "For I came down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him that sent me. And this is the Father's will which hath sent me, that of all which he hath given me, I should lose nothing, but I should raise it up again at the last day." What was foremost on Jesus' mind was to do his Father's will. It was the will of God that the people should be saved, and Jesus knew what needed to happen, his death, and the timing that would be needed. He set up events so they would culminate in his crucifixion to achieve that end. The last crowded act of Jesus' life was about to open. The Feast of the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread were really two different things. The Feast of the Passover fell on the day 14th Nisan, which is around early spring. The Feast of Unleavened Bread consisted of the 7 days following the Passover, and it began and ended with a holy convocation, meaning a high Sabbath, as referenced in John 19 and 31. The Feast of Unleavened Bread was one of three compulsory feasts. The other were Shavuot, that's Pentecost, or weeks, and Sukkot, tabernacles. Passover is tied into the three pilgrimage festivals. I can't pronounce it well. Shalosh Regalim, during which the Israelites of the kingdom of Judah made a pilgrimage to the temple in Jerusalem for the lamb or the goat to be slain. Samaritans still make this pilgrimage to Mount Gerizim, but only men participating in public worship. The Passover had a historical significance, as we're told in Exodus chapter 12. It commemorates the deliverance of the children of Israel from their bondage in Egypt. God had sent plague after plague on Egypt, but as each plague came, Pharaoh promised to let the people go. But when each plague abated, he hardened his heart and went back on his word. And finally came that terrible night where the angel of death swept through the land of Egypt to slay every firstborn son in every home. The Israelites were to slay a lamb. Using a bunch of hyssop, they were to smear the lintel of the doorpost plus the two doorposts with the blood of the lamb. And when the angel of death saw the doorpost so marked, it would pass over the house and its occupants would be safe. Before they went their way, the Israelites were to eat a meal of roasted lamb and unleavened bread. It was that Passover, that deliverance, and that meal that the Feast of the Passover commenced. Every possible preparation was made for the Passover. For a month beforehand, its meaning was expounded in the synagogues, and its lesson was taught daily in the schools. The aim was that no one should be ignorant and unprepared for the feast. The roads were all put in order ahead of time. The bridges were repaired. One special thing was done. It was very common to bury people by the side of the road. Now, if any pilgrim had touched one of these wayward tombs, he would technically have been in contact with a dead body and so rendered unclean and unable to partake of the feast, as we're told in Numbers 19 and 16. So before the Passover, the wayward tombs were all whitewashed so they would stand out and be obvious to the pilgrim so they could avoid them. Psalms 120 through 134 are entitled Psalms of Degree. And it may well be that these were the psalms of which the pilgrims sang on their way to the feast as they sought to lighten their load with music. And it is said that Psalm 122 was the one which they actually sang as they climbed the hill to the temple on the last stretch of their journey. It was compulsory for every adult male Jew who lived in Judea to come to the Passover, but far more than these actually came. It was the one ambition of every Jew to eat at least one Passover in Jerusalem before he died. Therefore, from every country in the world, pilgrims came flocking to the Passover feast. During the Passover, all lodging was free. Jerusalem could not hold the crowds, and Bethany, Bethphage, were two of the outlying villages where the pilgrims lodged. A passage in Josephus, that's from the works of Josephus, War of the Jews, Book 6, Chapter 9, Section 3, gives us an idea of how many pilgrims actually came. He tells us that Cestius, governor of Palestine around 65 AD, had some difficulty in persuading Nero of the great importance of the Jewish religion. To impress him, he asked the then high priest to take a census of the lambs slain at the Passover in 1 year. The number, according to Josephus, was 256,500. And reading right out of Josephus, so these high priests, upon the coming of their feast, which is called Passover, when they slay their sacrifices, from the ninth hour until the 11th, but so that a company not less than 10 belong to every sacrifice, for it is not lawful for them to feast singly by themselves. And many of us are 20 in a company. Found the number of sacrifices was 256,500, which, upon the allowance of no more than 10 that feast together, amounts to 2,700,200 persons that were pure and holy. That's a lot of pilgrims in old Jerusalem. Think about it. That city was not designed to handle that quantity of persons at that point in time. If it was just there that the problem of the Jewish authorities lay, or it was just there that the problem lay, during the Passover, feelings ran very high. The remembrance of the old deliverance from Egypt made the people long for a new deliverance from Rome. At no time was nationalist feeling so intense. Jerusalem was not the Roman headquarters in Judea. The governor had his residence and the soldiers were stationed at Caesarea. During the Passover time, special detachments of troops were drafted into Jerusalem and quartered in the Tower of Antonia, which overlooked the temple. The Romans knew that at Passover, anything might happen, and they were taking no chances. The Romans knew that at Passover, people were going to act in ways that they don't normally do. The Jewish authorities knew that in an inflammable atmosphere like that, the arrest of Jesus might provoke a riot. This is why they sought some secret strategy to arrest him and have him in their power before the populace knew anything about it. The last act of Jesus' life was to be played out in a city crammed with Jews who had come from the ends of the earth. They had come to commemorate the event whereby their nation was delivered from the slavery of Egypt long ago. It was at that very time that God's deliverer of mankind was crucified upon his cross. And as we read the narrative of the last week of his life, we cannot help but be struck with his efficiency in the arrangement. Everything was controlled. Everything was set up. Again and again, we see that he did not leave things until the last moment. Long before, he had arranged that the colt should be ready for his ride to carry him into Jerusalem. And here again, we see that all his arrangements have been made long beforehand. His disciples wished to know where they should eat the Passover. Jesus sent them into Jerusalem with instructions to look for a man carrying an earthen pitcher of water. That was a prearranged signal. To carry a water pot was typically a woman's duty. It was a thing that no man normally did. Excuse me. A man with a water pot on his shoulder would stand out in a crowd, as much as, say, a man on a wet day with a woman's umbrella. Jesus did not leave things until the last minute. Long ago, he had arranged for a last meeting place for himself and for his disciples, and had arranged just how it was to be found. The larger Jewish houses had an upper room. Such houses looked exactly like a smaller box that's placed on top of a bigger box, or a box stacked on a box. The smaller box was the upper room, and it was approached normally by an outside staircase. You didn't go through the house to get into it. The upper room had many uses that it could be used for. It was used as a storeroom. It was used as a place for quiet meditation. It was used as a guest room for visitors. It could be used for a banquet. But in particular, it was the place where a rabbi taught his chosen band of intimate disciples. Jesus was following the custom that any Jewish rabbi might follow. Most Jerusalem homes would simply be a single-story house. To have a large upper room, furnished and ready, suggests a certain amount of prosperity. We must remember the Jewish way of reckoning days. The new day began at roughly, we use the clock time of 6 p.m. Obviously, it changes with the seasons, but it starts in the evening. So it's the evening and the morning of the day. So up until 6 p.m., it was 13th Nisan, the day of the preparation for the Passover. But 14th Nisan, the Passover day, began at roughly 6 p.m. And to put it in English terms, Wednesday the 14th began at 6 p.m. on Tuesday the 13th. But what were the preparations that a Jew made for the Passover? First was the ceremonial search for the leaven. Before the Passover, every particle of leaven must be banished from a house. That was because the first Passover in Egypt, in Exodus 12, had to be eaten with unleavened bread. Unleavened bread is not like bread at all. It's more like a water biscuit. It had been used in Egypt because it can be baked much more quickly than a loaf of bread that's baked with leaven. In the first Passover, the Passover escape from Egypt had to be eaten in haste, with everyone ready for the open road. In addition, leaven was a symbol of corruption. We're well familiar with that. Leaven is fermented dough, and the Jew identified fermentation with putrefaction. And so leaven stood for rottenness. The day before the Passover, the master of the house took a lighted candle and ceremonially searched the house for leaven. Before the search, he prayed, "Blessed art thou, Yahweh, our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us by thy commandments and commanded us to remove the leaven." They went about and did the search in the house, including all the family members, children. They were all involved in conducting the search. And at the end of the search, and after the end, they found all the pieces they could. They pulled out pots and pans and went into the corners of every cabinet looking for any specks of leaven that was there to get rid of it. But at the end of the search, the householder says, all the leaven that is in my possession, that which I have seen and that which I have not seen, be it null, be accounted as the dust of the earth. Interestingly to note, the product of the leavening process is the same unclean waste that expelled by us from our lungs, of our cursed flesh, carbon dioxide. As the bacteria feed on the flour, it expels the same unclean gas as outbreathing sin-cursed human beings. Further, it is the trees of life in the creational order that scrub our atmosphere from carbon dioxide, as well as expel clean oxygen through the photosynthesis process. Next, on the afternoon before the Passover evening, came the sacrifice of the Passover lamb. All the people came to the temple. The worshiper must slay his own lamb, thereby, as it were, making his own sacrifice. But in Jewish eyes, all blood was sacred to God, because the Jew equated the blood with life. It was quite natural to do so, because if a person or an animal is wounded, as the blood flows out, so does the life, which makes the practice of phlebotomy or bloodletting very confusing. Why would somebody do that if it's your life? So in the temple, the worshiper slew his own lamb. Between the worshipers and the altar were two long lines of priests, each with a gold or a silver bowl. As the lamb's throat was slit, the blood was caught in one of these bowls and passed up the line until the priest at the end dashed the blood upon the altar. If the figures in Josephus are anywhere near correct, and there was more than 250,000 lambs slain, the scene in the temple courts and the blood-stained conditions of the altar, we can't even imagine today. The lamb was carried home to be roasted. It must not be boiled. It had to be roasted over an open fire on a spit. I read in one place that the spit was made of pomegranate wood. The spit went right through the lamb from mouth to vent, and the lamb had to be roasted entire with its head and its legs and its tail still attached to the body. Just like the substance, Jesus casting the Passover lamb shadow, not a bone was to be broken. This offers an extreme emphasis on why the unleavened memorial bread of Christ's flesh had to be broken, demonstrating the breaking of the power of sin in Christ's flesh and not a mere broken bone. The table itself was shaped like a square. It was open on one side. It was low, and the guests reclined on couches, resting on their left arms with their right arms free for eating. And certain things were necessary. These were the things the disciples would have to get ready. First, there was a lamb to remind them of how their houses had been protected by the badge of blood when the angel of death passed through Egypt. Second, there was the unleavened bread to remind them of the bread that they had eaten in haste when they escaped from slavery. Third, there was a bowl of salt water to remind them of the tears they had shed in Egypt and the waters of the Red Sea through which they had miraculously passed through to get to safety. Fourth, there was the collection of bitter herbs, horseradish, chicory, endive, lettuce, horehound. That's an old world bitter perennial mint with downy leaves to remind them of the bitterness of slavery that they encountered in Egypt. Fifth, there was a paste called karoshef, a mixture of apples, dates, pomegranates, and nuts to remind them of the clay which they had made bricks in Egypt. And through it were the sticks of cinnamon to remind them of the straw with which the bricks had been made. And sixth, there were four cups of wine. The cups contained a little more than half a pint of wine, but three parts of wine were mixed with two of water. And the four cups, which were drunk at different stages of the meal, were to remind them of the four promises from Exodus chapter 6, verses 6 and 7. I will bring you out from under the burdens of Egyptians. I will rid you of their bondage. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm. I will take you to me for a people, and I will be your God. Such were the preparations which had to be made for the Passover. Every detail spoke of the great day of deliverance, of when God liberated his people from their bondage in Egypt. It was at that feast that he liberated the world from sin, was to sit at his last meal with his disciples. As Jesus arranges his last meal with his disciples, we have no sense that he is not in control. He is definitely in control. He knows about the room, just as he knew about the colt. He also knows who will betray him. As Mark tells the story, this is a Passover meal. There is no mention of a roast lamb or bitter herbs in Mark's account, but Jesus' thoughts are on the meaning of the festival. For Mark 14 and 12, since the Passover meal had to be eaten within Jerusalem's walls, the disciples asked Jesus where he wanted them to go to make preparations for the meal. They assumed that he would eat this family feast with him. And continuing Mark 14, verses 13 and 15, this episode is structurally parallel to an earlier version or an earlier story in Mark chapter 11, starting at the beginning. It may reflect another instance of Jesus' supernatural knowledge. From the beginning of Mark 11, when they had come nigh to Jerusalem unto Bethphage and Bethany at the Mount of Olives, he sendeth forth two of his disciples, and saith unto them, Go your way into the village over against you, and as soon as ye be entered into it, ye shall find a colt tied, whereon never man sat. Loose him, and bring him. And if any man say unto you, Why do ye this? Say ye that the Lord hath need of him, and straightway he will send him hither. And they went their way, and found the colt tied by the door, without, in a place where two ways met, and they loose him. And certain of them that stood there said unto them, What do ye, loosing the colt? And they said unto them, Even as Jesus had commanded. And they let them go. And they brought the colt to Jesus, and cast their garments on him, and he sat upon him. However, Jesus was aware of events and his surroundings, and he deemed the need of security due to Judas Iscariot's thoughts and actions that were recorded in Mark 14, verses 10 and 11. And Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went unto the chief priests to betray him unto them. And when they heard it, they were glad, and promised to give him money. And he sought how he might conveniently betray him. When Jesus' disciples questioned him regarding the location to set up the Passover, for the Passover meal, his subsequent directives seemed to indicate that he had carefully reserved a place in advance where they could eat the Passover meal together, undisturbed. Jesus and his disciples were probably in Bethany, as this is the last location that's noted in verse 3 of chapter 14. And being in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, as he sat at meal, there came a woman having an alabaster box of ointment of spikenard, very precious. And she brake the box and poured it on his head. Jesus sent two disciples to prepare the meal. Luke 22 and verse 8 specifies that he sent Peter and John into Jerusalem with instructions for locating the reserved room. Reading from Luke, And he sent Peter and John, saying, Go and prepare us the Passover, that we may eat. Even during these final preparations for his death, Jesus was doing miraculous things. In this instance, he told Peter and John exactly what they would find when they went about the preparations for the Passover. Judas was listening, too, for the answer to, Where? Where are they going? Thinking that it would give him the opportunity which he had sought to betray him, in absence of the multitude. But Jesus had much to say to his disciples. He wasn't quite finished yet. They needed the quiet hours in the upper room to get his last message out and across. Therefore, he sent away the two disciples with directions which revealed nothing to the others. If he had told the group where the house was, the Last Supper may never have been instituted, nor the precious farewell words, the Holy of Holy of John's Gospel, ever been spoken. Jesus was taking precautions to delay the cross, but he takes none to escape it, but rather he sets himself in these last days to bring it near. The variety of his action means no change in his mind, but both modes are equally the result of his self-forgetting love to us all. So he sends away Peter and John with what we call sealed orders, as it were, and the greedy ears of the traitor are balked. For John 11 and 55, and the Jews' Passover was nigh at hand, and many went out of the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Then sought they for Jesus, and spake among themselves as they stood in the temple, what think ye, that he will not come to the feast? Now both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a commandment, that if any man knew where he were, he should show it, that they might take him. A man carrying a jar of water would meet the two disciples, presumably near the eastern gate. This man would lead them to a house with a large upper room, where they could share the Passover away from the hostility and the public gaze. Like the unbroken colt and the unused tomb, this room is furnished and ready. This unusual eye-catching sight suggests that it was a prearranged signal, but normally only women carried jars of water. Men carried wineskins. We can see in the book of Joshua, chapter 9, the story of the Gentiles. The Gibeonites, who deceived Israel, were brought into the camp, were made hewers of wood and drawers of water. So if you saw a man in the Old Testament carrying water, he was a second-class citizen. He was only allowed to stay there because the oath of God was upon him, and he had to accept those menial tasks. Hewers of wood and drawers of water. If you see a man carrying a pitcher of water, you have a cameo of humility. Though I can't prove it, I still believe that this pot of water that this man drew is the same water that Jesus will use later to wash the disciples' feet. They were to follow this man, apparently a servant, who would lead them to the right house. This servant was a monument of humility, and they were specially instructed to basically follow in his footsteps, where the house that he entered in. Go this exact same place, the same humility way. They were to tell the owner, the teacher asks, where is my guest room? The word used for room in the biblical text is translated as guest chamber. That word is only used in two other occasions. One of the other two is in the parallel account given in Mark 14, verse 14. Where do you think the other usage is? It is used in Luke chapter 2, in verse 7, with regard to the birth of Jesus. And he being laid in a manger, because there was no room in the inn, is the other usage. At his birth, the world had no room for Jesus. At his approaching death, he was making room for all the world that would follow him in that guest chamber, the upper room. Jesus was known as the teacher. Mark 4 and 38 is an example of this. And as he was in the hinder part of the ship, asleep on the pillow, and they awake him and say unto him, Master, carest thou not that we perish? The word used for master is Strong's number 1320. I'm not going to try to pronounce it. It's a masculine noun from didasco, to teach, instructor, master, teacher. The single self-designation teacher implies that Jesus was well known to the owner, and the possessive pronoun my implies his prior arrangement to use that room. He, the autos, or the owner himself, would show them a large upper room built on the flat ceiling, furnished with a dining table and reclining couches, and set up for a banquet meal. The owner may have also secured the necessary food, including the Passover lamb. The two disciples were to prepare the meal for Jesus and for the disciples at that location. The upper room was above the earth, to speak things above earthly considerations. Tradition in some Christadelphian brothers that I have talked to suggest that this is Mark's home, and the owner was Mark's father. As the true answer to this question is not written in Scripture for us, placing a name is just speculating. So don't speculate. Mark 14 and 16, presuming that preparing the Passover meal involved roasting the lamb, setting out the unleavened bread and wine, and preparing bitter herbs along with a sauce made of dried fruit moistened with vinegar and wine and combined with spices. These Passover preparation in Jesus' last meal with his disciples was the regular Passover meal held that same evening. And he was crucified the following morning, which is still the same Jewish day. This is the consistent witness of the Gospels. Those are some references on your screen. This was the Passover proper, and also the preparation for the seven-day feast of the unleavened bread, which is sometimes called the Passover week. Now the question is of a secret rendezvous. This is one of the obscure and less noticed incidents, but perhaps it contains more valuable teaching than appears at first sight. The first question that comes to our mind is preparation or knowledge of the upper room, was it a miracle or is it a plan? Does the incident mean supernatural knowledge or a preconcerted token, like the provisions of the ass and the entry of Jerusalem? I think there's nothing that's decisive either way in the narrative. Perhaps the balance of probability lies in the favor of the latter theory. The difficulty in this way is that no communication seems to pass between the two disciples and the man by which he could know them to be the persons whom he was to precede into the house. There are advantages in either theory, which the other loses on the whole. But on the whole, I incline to believe that it's a preconcerted or prearranged signal. But if we lose the supernatural, we gain the suggestion of prudence and human adaption, a means to an end, which makes the story even more startling real to us. So whichever theory we adopt, the main points and lessons of the narrative remain the same. The remarkable thing in the story is the picture it gives us of Christ as elaborately adopting precautions to conceal the place. They are at Bethany. The disciples ask, where is the Passover to be eaten? The easy answer would be just to tell them, there's the address over here. Give them the name of the man in the house where they're going to go. That is not given. The deliberate roundaboutness of the answer remains the same whether miracle or plan. The two go away, and the others know nothing about the place. Probably the messengers did not come back. But in the evening, Jesus and the ten go straight to the house, which only he knew. All this secrecy is in strong contrast with Jesus' normal, frank, and open appearances. What is the reason? To baffle the traitor from preventing him from acquiring previous knowledge of the place. He was watching for some quiet hour in Jerusalem to take Jesus. So Christ does not eat the Passover at the house of any well-known disciple who had a house in Jerusalem, but goes to some man unknown to the apostolic circle and takes steps to prevent the place from being known beforehand. All this looks like ordinary precautions which a man who knew of the plots against him would take. It might simply mean as a way to, or a wish to save his life. But is that the whole explanation? Why did he wish to baffle the traitor? Because of his desire to eat the Passover with his disciples, his loving sympathy. Because of his desire to found a new rite of his kingdom. Because of his desire to bring his death into immediate connection with the Paschal sacrifice. There was no reason of a selfish kind, no shrinking from death itself. The fact that such precautions only meet us here, and that they stand in strongest contrast with the rest of his conduct, emphasizes the purely voluntary nature of his death, how he chose to be betrayed, taken, and to die. They suggest the same thought has to do with the staggering back of his would-be captors in Gethsemane. At his majestic word, "I am he, let these go their way." The narrative sets him forth as the Lord of all circumstances, as free and arranging all events. Judas, the priests, Pilate, the soldiers, were swept with a power which they did not know, to deeds which they did not understand. The Lord of all gives himself up in rather royal freedom to the death, to which nothing dragged him but his own love for his Father. Such seems to be the lessons of this narrative, insofar as it bears our Lord's own thoughts and feelings. And also note the authoritative claim which he makes. One reading is, "My guest chamber," and that makes his claim even more emphatic. But apart from that, the language is strong in its expression of a right to this unknown man's upper room. Note the singular blending here, as in all his earthly life, of poverty and dignity, with the lowliness of being obligated to a man for a room, the royal style, "The Master saith." So even now there's a blending of the wonderful facts that he puts himself in the position of needing anything from us, with the absolute authority in which he claims over us and ours. Jesus knows, disciples from the other disciples know not. This man was one of the secret disciples. There is no excuse for shrinking from confession of his name, but it is blessed to believe that his eyes see many a hidden one. He recognizes their faith and gives them work to do. Add the striking thought that though this man's name is unrecorded as an evangelist, it is known to Christ, was written in his heart, and to use a prophetic image, was graven on the palms of his hands. How honored that man felt then. How much more so as the years went on. How most of us now. Our greatest blessedness is that he does come into the narrow room of our hearts. If any man open the door, I will sup with him.